Hello, welcome to Home Baking. My name is Kate and I'm the host of this podcast, which is all about adventures in home baking through ingredients, recipes, history and culture. So today I'm going to be explaining a few changes that I've made to the podcast, and I'm going to be talking, more importantly, I'm going to be talking about the ups and downs of two quite tricky bakes that I attempted for this episode. So one of them is a Slovenian festive bread called petica, which I flavoured with tarragon, which is very traditional. And the other is kozanak, which is a Bulgarian enriched bread commonly eaten at Easter in particular. So that's what I'm going to be talking about today. I'm also going to be doing a little feature about Easter breads around Europe and talking a little bit about what I've learned so far in my adventures in Central and Eastern European baking. So very excited to get started, and I'll see you on the other side of the music. So welcome to an all new look podcast and a slight rebrand. So I'm still proud of the work that I've done in flour, butter, eggs, sugar, and I'm not really looking to kind of delete that or anything. But I think that I've grown, and I think the podcast has grown, and I've kind of decided that what I enjoy doing the most, and I think also what other people might enjoy more, is a little bit less going through recipes and a little bit more storytelling. So I still want to like try things out and try out different bakes and kind of report back. So I don't want to take that out, but I feel like a lot of you probably know how to make bread or cakes or biscuits. You don't really need me to sort of repeatedly tell you. So what I'm going to do is just focus on how I found baking it, any tips and tricks that might be different from the norm, and also a bit more, you know, of a focus on culture and history. So it's kind of like all my favourite things into one, especially if I include a bit of religious history. And that's really, really my jam. So that's kind of where the podcast is pivoting to now, and I hope that you're good with that. And then the other big change that I've made, other than the name, which is mainly just to make it easier to search this. And by the way, the other change that I'm making that's quite big is I'm moving over. So the website since the start has been flourbuttereggsugar.com, which has been hosted on WordPress. And I'm subscribed to a few newsletters from food writers, and I really love I just really love receiving the newsletters in my inbox. And I think that let's be honest, it's more fashionable. And I think it's just a nice way to keep in touch with the podcast. So that's what I'm doing. So we're going to be hosted on Substack, and it's just homebaking.substack.com. That's where you can find it, and it's going to all be free. So just go over there to subscribe. And if you don't want to subscribe, but you still want to see the posts, you don't have to put your email in when it directs you towards that. When you're on that page, you can do a cross. You can tick the cross in the right-hand top corner, and then you can still see the posts. So yeah, those are the changes. The name, a slightly different focus, and moving over to Substack. So yeah, I had a couple of weeks off, and it got me thinking. I was listening to old episodes and reflecting on where we've been and where we're going, and I just think this is a really, I think and hope that these are really sort of positive changes, and I'm really looking forward to getting my teeth stuck into. I've got some incredibly exciting episode ideas. So I'm really happy about that. And I think having this new focus has given me a lot of inspiration for like very interesting episodes and themes. So can't wait really. So I want to just talk a little bit about some history and culture stuff, about Easter breads around Europe, and a little bit about Eastern European baking. And then we will get into our main bakes for today. So let's do our super speedy tour around Europe and Easter breads. So let's start in Germany. So in Germany, there are kind of two. So there's Kugelhopf, which is often described as a kind of yeasted cake, but it's not hugely sweet. So I feel like you could also describe it instead as a sweet bread. And it's very high-sided. It's made in a molded tin, which is actually called a Kugelhopf pan. And it's most popular in Germany, as well as France, Switzerland, and Austria. Something that you realize through food history is that even though there are distinct nations, I'm not taking that away from anybody, and languages, you know, for most of history, the borders in Europe have been very porous and actually still are a lot of the time, in the EU at least. So, yeah, so it's kind of, and you can see that in the way that the food spills over into different places. So that's Kugelhopf. The other one in Germany is Osterbrot, which is a kind of marzipan bread. So it's got an almond paste inside and it's got almonds on top a lot of the time. And I learned from this a couple of things. So one of them is that the word marzipan originally comes from I don't know how this is pronounced exactly, but marcepane, which means March bread. So really common to flavour springtime celebration things with marzipan. But now marzipan is, of course, used a lot of other times of year too. So I don't know if it was ever specifically just used in March or Easter time, or if it was just more common then. But that is the origin of the word marzipan, which I found really, really interesting. The other thing I learnt is that Easter, the word for Easter actually comes from Estra, which comes from the word egg, and it predates Christianity in Europe, so that, you know, it sort of, Easter sort of superseded a pagan festival, Ostra, if that's how it's pronounced, and a lot of the symbolism is sort of borrowed from that festival, especially eggs. That I found that really, really interesting. Okay, so let's keep talking about breads. So, there are lots of different other ones that we could talk about. So let's go over to Ukraine now. So there's a bread called pashka, I think that is how it's pronounced, but I could be wrong, which is an enriched bread and adorned with symbols. And they also have something called babka, which just means, as I've talked about in a previous episode, babka basically comes from the word for grandmother, which is a sort of tall cylindrical bread. And they have babka also in Poland, but babka in Poland is commonly made in a mold, whereas babka in Ukraine is often more like just a sort of tall, high-sided loaf, cylindrical loaf. Okay, so let's head over to Greece now, where the Easter bread is tsoureki, which is quite similar really to kozanak and various other breads, but it's often flavoured with mastic resin, which has a kind of piney flavour. If you've never tried it, I love it, it's delicious. I especially love the mastic flavoured lemonade that I can get from my local Greek shop. It's absolutely phenomenal. And it's also often flavoured with mehlebi or maleb. and it's also decorated with coloured eggs. So I was at my Greek shop, the same one, and I saw that they had some maleb, or how I would thought it was pronounced, melepi seeds. So I was went up to the counter and I was buying my bits and bobs, and they said, is there anything else that you wanted? Because I always go in and just like poke around looking at things, because they know that I don't really mind if they perceive me as a English woman who doesn't really know what I'm doing, because it's true. So I'm happy to get the help. So they were saying like, is there anything else that you wanted? And I said, yeah, I noticed that you have melepi seeds. Do you have any ground melepi? And they just looked at me really confused. And I said, maleb? Melepi? And they said, ah, you mean mehlebi? And I was like, yes. So I learned how to actually pronounce it, at least in Greek. I still don't know how Turkish people pronounce it. And I don't think that my pronunciation is perfect by any means, but mehlebi is more accurate, apparently. So I learned something. Okay, so let's go over to Italy now, where a common Easter bread is pane di Pasqua. And by the way, Pasqua and Pasca, or Pasca, they just mean Easter. That's all they mean. So Easter bread, it just means pane di Pasqua, and it's commonly braided into a circle, and then it has coloured eggs sort of around and about it, sometimes inside it. And a common flavouring in the Italian pane di Pasqua is aniseed. So next up we have got pinza. I think that it's a ts, because in other Slavic languages like Slovenian, a C is a ts sound. So that's why petitsa is not petika or petisa. We were corrected on that one. It's petitsa. So I think it's pinza, which is, yeah. So it's Croatian, but also in some parts of Slovenia and Italy, they have it as well. And it's like a ball with a cross scored in the top. It looks really simple, actually. And it often includes rum-soaked raisins. Now, another country that loves dried fruit is my country. So hot cross buns, obviously, are very popular in Britain. They usually have like a lovely sticky top, and they have a piped cross on top, which is generally just made with water and flour. But you can use icing if you prefer. I wouldn't, because that's not that wouldn't toast well. And we love toasting bread in this country, so it has to be toastable for us. But there are also regional variations and regional traditions. I'm sure this is true in loads of other countries too. So for example, I think it was last Easter I spoke about Cornish saffron buns, which, like, it's really sad that they have almost died out really anywhere other than Cornwall, but because they are incredibly delicious. And we actually, you know, grow saffron saffron crocuses in Cornwall. So I really do think they deserve a comeback. I mean, it's not very affordable to, you know, you wouldn't make it every week, but I think for a special occasion, if you can afford it, I think making saffron buns is brilliant. So let's go back to Eastern Europe for a second, with the Russian bread kulish or kulish. I'm not entirely sure, or is it kulich? Kulich, I don't know. But it's a tall bread with very classic flavourings. A lot of Easter breads around Europe have these types of flavourings, things like zest, dried fruit, candied peel, and warm spices. If you ever see British recipe and it says mixed spice, that's kind of what we use in loads of things. Like, we use it in Christmas cake, we use it in hot cross buns, and I often don't buy it. I often just make up my own spice mix, so don't feel inhibited by British recipes in that way. You can just look up what is in British mixed spice and then make up your own little spice mix. The curveball that people don't realise is in British kind of sweet baking is ground coriander. Like, we use that alongside the things you might more commonly think of, like cinnamon, cloves, nutmeg. Ground coriander, that's kind of the key to mixed spice, which a lot of people don't know, including a lot of my country people, I would imagine, because a lot of us don't actually bake, which is a shame. Everyone always is like, oh my God, you're so good at baking. And I'm like, I mean, I love baking. I'm really passionate about baking, but most of the baking I do is really quite simple. Okay, so we're going to go to Portugal now, and Folha de Pascoa. So this is another braided one. It has a kind of braided top, but more plain sides, and it contains hard-boiled eggs. Interesting. So I don't know if those are meant to be eaten or if they are just for decoration. And then next door to Portugal, in Spain, a common Easter bread is jonatzo, which is stuffed with eggs and sausage. It's like a savory bread. Honestly, it sounds so good for breakfast. And okay, so we're going to go right up north now to Sweden. And can you guess what kind of spice they love in Sweden? Obviously cardamom. They absolutely love the stuff. They have it in semla buns, which are like the sort of Fat Tuesday buns that they love before they loved eating just before Lent. They also have cardamomabula, just kind of all year round, basically, or maybe not, you know, traditionally, maybe not in Lent, but Sweden is not very religious anymore. So they probably have it pretty much all year round, which are like, you know, they're like cinnamon buns, but with cardamom. So they just love cardamom in their baking in Sweden. They really do. And by the way, vetebröd just means like wheat bread. It's a very generic name. Okay. So yeah, that's a very, very quick whistle stop tour all around Europe, all about different Easter breads. And yeah, you can see that a lot of them have so much in common. So I'm now going to talk a little bit about Central and Eastern European baking, and then we will get into the actual bakes that I tackled this episode. So here are a few things that I have learned about Central and Eastern European baking. So the first one is that rum is extremely important as a flavouring. Now, I often don't have it in the house, honestly, because neither of us drink. So sometimes I will use brandy, which is kind of very British, I'm afraid. But you can use, you know, some sort of like kind of rich type of spirit, you know. I think a lot of the time, like a spiced rum would be really, really good, actually. But yeah, rum is really important as it kind of gives a background flavouring to a lot of different bakes. Another important one is poppy seed. There's some sort of version of a poppy seed roll, like all around Central and Eastern Europe, like under many different names. Walnuts are really important partly because they're a local crop. Sour cream is really important. Commonly, rather than using vanilla extract or vanilla paste, they use vanilla flavored sugar. So that's a really important ingredient as well. But if you don't have it, you can definitely just use whatever you've got in that regard. Often curd cheese is important as well. So I've talked before about Ukrainian curd cheese biscuits that I made that were really nice. Blueberries are really important, and plums, and rye and buckwheat. Again, because they're all local crops. And talking of local crops, seasonality is really important, I found as well. When I went to Slovenia, you could see how important it was, because we went at springtime. And so, you know, we were served a lot of things like dandelion leaves, which, you know, were common at that time of year. I had a really delicious, like, it was like a tongue and dandelion leaf salad, which sounds gross, but it was genuinely really delicious. But yeah, so very sort of springtime menus we saw a lot. There's a lot of countryside in Slovenia as well, and a lot of farming. So, and so with the seasonality, it means that you, there's certain fruits that you would only bake with, you know, when they're in season at the particular times of the year. However, when they're not in season, you can use them in other forms. So, you know, if you've got a massive crop, you might turn some of it into a jam. You might dry some of it, and you might make some of it into a fruit butter. So things like plum butters are really common. I learned about that in my Romanian baking book, Tava. And it's just essentially you juice the fruit, or you actually use the pulp, I think. So you've got the fruit pulp and you just very slowly over a low heat reduce it for absolutely ages, until you've got this kind of thick, like paste, I guess. So yeah, that's kind of the way around, you know, the cold months. So you've still got something with flavor. I found that crumb cakes and yeasted cakes and also yeasted sweetbreads are very important. And also something that I found really interesting is sweet dumplings are more of a thing. So we saw this in Slovenia, but there's also some in my Romanian book. And when I go to the Polish restaurant that I go to, they have them as well, like versions of kind of pasta or dumplings that, you know, sometimes you might have in a savory way. There's a rolled dumpling called strukli in Slovenia that you do this with. So you might have, sometimes it might be stuffed with meat or cheese or vegetables. And then at other times you might have it stuffed with strawberries and sugar. And yeah, it's very similar in various other countries. So that's something I found really, really interesting. And I learned from a podcast the other day. I've been listening to a Taste of the Past from Heritage Radio Network, and their episode that was on kind of the history of Italian food was really interesting. They had an Italian, a historian of Italian food on, and they used to eat a lot of like pasta with sweet sauces and stuff, more like in the past. I found that super interesting. And then also in Eastern Europe, the countries that were ruled by the Ottomans have much more of a Middle Eastern influence. So you find things like rose flavorings, orange blossom, mehlebi or maleb. Whereas in countries that are nearer to places like Germany and Austria, you find more things like chopped pancakes and waffles. So yeah, that's a little bit about my adventures in Central and Eastern European baking so far, which I've been absolutely loving. So let's get into talking about our two bakes this week. So first up, we have got our stringy Bulgarian kozanak. So in Bulgarian, there's this expression about kozanak that it should be made of strings. Now, what I've noticed from looking at a lot of blogs by Bulgarians is that it seems to be more important to some than others. So with my Romanian kozanak recipe, that isn't stringy. It's not really meant to be either, but it has a really incredible filling. But a lot of Bulgarians, not all, but a lot of Bulgarians really look for this very particular texture. So you want the bread to sort of, if you pull it out, you get these kind of strings of baked dough, but it's also very fluffy at the same time. And I'll tell you what, it's really quite tricky to achieve that. I've gotten kind of close, but it's not fully there yet. And I think maybe by the time Orthodox Easter actually comes around, I might be ready to, they might actually be the right texture. But I did get close. And so I am going to be sharing my recipe in case any of you want to have a go. And even if you don't get that stringy texture that's characteristic, you will still have an incredibly delicious bread, like regardless. So let's talk about the recipe. So in terms of ingredients, you've got 3 medium to large eggs. You've got quite a lot of yeast, so about 12 grams of fast action yeast. I've given notes about if you want to use a different type of yeast as well. 50 grams of sour cream, or you can use like a strained yogurt if you prefer. Some sugar, 200 grams of sugar, 700 grams of strong white flour. So mine is about 12%. I've spoken before about how British flour is quite weak. So if you want to use all purpose and you're in North America, it probably will be the same as my strong. So you probably can build up your gluten enough to work. You also want some salt, 8 grams of salt, 100 grams of butter, which is going to needs to be soft, 200 grams or milliliters of milk, 25 grams or milliliters of rum, or you could use another alcohol that might complement the flavour, such as amaretto or brandy. I wouldn't use necessarily a liqueur here because it might be, I think it might overwhelm the flavour. So I didn't use, for example, what's it called? The orange liqueur stuff. I've got a bottle of that in the cupboard. I think maybe a teaspoon would be okay. Cointreau is what I'm thinking of. But I feel like the rum is meant to provide this sort of warmth at the back of your palate. It's not meant to be a really like punchy sort of flavour. So that's why I would recommend maybe brandy as an alternative. You also want 2 teaspoons of vanilla. So it's traditional to use sugar, but obviously extract and paste are okay too. The zest of a lemon and the zest of an orange. You also want a bit of extra butter for greasing your bowl and loaf pans if you want to use a loaf pan. And some vegetable oil of some kind, like sunflower, grapeseed, for greasing your hands and the work surface when you're shaping. And then you also want, on top of all that, an egg yolk, a splash of egg white, milk or water to thin it out, and a few handfuls of some sort of coarse sugar, like demerara or turbinado, or just granulated if that's what you've got. And those are for the egg wash and sort of sugaring. What I haven't included, which is very common, and you can include it if you want, is rum-soaked raisins. And there are other flavourings too, but, you know, some sort of dried fruit is common. But I was really focused on getting the texture right, so I just went with quite a simple flavouring, which is absolutely fine as well. So I'm not going to go through the full list of instructions, but I'll just point out a few ways in which this differs from a regular bread recipe. So what I would say is you want to have the right temperature liquids. That's normal for bread. I would say beat in everything else except the butter first, and then build up that gluten, knead that really well. And then once you've got really good gluten development, then add your butter. You want to shape it before you do your first rise. And then once it's had its first rise, you're going to flatten it and you're going to shape it into 6 different bits, 6 different rolls. Then what I would do is shape. So you're then going to make 2 loaves out of this amount. So you're going to make it into 6 strands. And I would start with making 3 strands at a time. And I would recommend shaping those strands, because if you don't, what might happen is that the kind of dough all kind of melts together or all kind of like smushes together, and you don't get the stringy texture as much. So that's what I would recommend, is shaping that by kind of like flattening the flattening, sort of making it into a rope, flattening that on your work surface that's greased, then stitching it together. So you pull in the two sides horizontally and stitch those together. Does that make sense? It's something that is common in bread shaping, is that sort of stitching method. And then I would roll it on the work surface as well, just to help build some bit of surface tension. And then you braid it. And then it's baked at quite a low temperature because it's quite large. You can bake it into loaf pans or you can bake it into free form things. Either is fine. But it's baked at a low temperature. I actually did 170°C or 325 Fahrenheit, which is really low for bread, but because it's so heavily enriched, it's got a lot of sugar in it. In particular, if you bake it at a high temperature, it will literally just burn on the outside and have a raw middle. So very much worth thinking about that one, and not burning it ideally. So that is our Cosenac. Now, it is quite a bit of a it's a little bit of a mission to make it, I would say. I enjoyed the process of making it and I think it's incredibly delicious. I love the way that it's flavoured with lemon and orange zest. It's really citrusy, even though in two whole loaves, all you're using is the zest of one lemon and one orange. But it really takes on that flavour. It's very, very delicious. I loved having the crunchy sugar on the outside. I really do love it. And I think it gets easier with time. So the more you do it, the better you get at it. So I am going to attempt it one more time, at least for this year. And then I might wait until next Easter. But yeah, I think I am going to keep making it because I do really enjoy it. And I love getting feedback from my Bulgarian neighbour, Svetla, who is, you know, she misses her grandmother and would love to have her grandmother's Cosenac, which I'm not going to be able to replicate, but I can try and make something that is filled with love for her to enjoy. So that is Cosenac. So next up, we're going to talk about Tarragon Petitza. So Tarragon Petitza is really interesting. I had it when I was in Slovenia. They use tarragon only in sweet foods in Slovenia, which is pretty interesting. So when I was there, we had it in ice cream with curd cheese, which was incredibly delicious. And I've also had it, this wasn't in Slovenia, but I've also had it in lemonade, which is also banging. Like one of the most popular soft drinks in Georgia is tarragon lemonade. It absolutely slaps. Now what I would recommend is, if you ever go to Slovenia, there's this local drink, Soviet era drink, called kokta. So, you know, during the Cold War, they couldn't import a lot of Western goods, they couldn't have Coke, so they came up with this thing called kokta, which doesn't taste anything like Coke, but it's delicious in its own right, and it has a much more herbaceous flavor. It's made, I think the primary flavouring is rose hip. So it's like really interesting and really good. So this is another tricky one, Tarragon Petitza. And I've got a few things that I would recommend for it. One is it's important the size of pan that you use. So we'll talk a teeny bit about that. Another is how you incorporate the tarragon into it. That's really important. And finally, how you get a really good roll is really important. But I do love having tarragon in sweet foods. I think it's incredibly delicious. It's like unusual, but great. I just love all of those aniseed flavours anyway. So I was kind of sold from the get-go. Because like in Britain, at least, it's very underrated, tarragon. You really only see it paired with chicken. But it's like so yummy. Like there's a Rukminiya recipe, which I make during summer when tomatoes are more in season. And it's for a sort of tomato salad that uses tarragon, and that's really, really good there as well. But yeah, we don't really use it very much here, which I think is a shame. I think you can grow it in Britain or near Britain. I'm sure you can grow it in Britain at certain times of year. It'll be in season. So yeah, why don't we have it? Sad times. Okay, so for the ingredients for this one, you want this is for one large loaf, 450 grams of strong white flour. You want 10 grams of instant or fast action yeast. You can use other types of yeast, but in a slightly different way. You want 75 grams of sugar. So not as sweet as the Cosinac, but then you've got more sugar going into the filling. About 4 grams of salt, 3/4 of a tablespoon of rum, or again, you could use brandy or something similar. 300 milliliters of milk, a slightly heaped teaspoon of vanilla, 6 grams, 38 grams of butter, melted and cooled, 55 grams of egg yolks, which is about 3 egg yolks if you've got large eggs, and then half a lemon, but just the zest. And then for the filling, you want 38 grams of butter, 3 tablespoons of breadcrumbs, an egg yolk, 135 grams of sour cream, 113 grams of granulated sugar. You could use castor as well, actually. 6 grams or a heaped teaspoon of vanilla, and about 100 grams of fresh tarragon. Now, I found that that's really strong. And I, by the way, I reduced the amount from the original recipe I was using. 100 grams is also really quite strong. So you might want to take that down to sort of 75. So I'll put that, I'm putting that in the recipe, and then it's up to you what you would prefer to do. So in terms of the recipe, so it's really quite a standard bread, enriched bread recipe. The filling is a bit different. So for the filling, the first time I made this, right, I didn't chop the tarragon very finely. And what we ended up with was in the middle of our, in our bread, in the filling, we had all these like slimy bits of tarragon. It was really quite gross. So what I would recommend here is whizzing the tarragon and sugar in a food processor to make sure that tarragon is finely chopped and it's going to be eaten nicely distributed. So that's a really important step. If you're using dried tarragon, it's not so much of an issue. So you can kind of skip that step. Now, the other thing that I found interesting is the way that it uses breadcrumbs. And you melt the butter in a pan and stir in the breadcrumbs and just fry that gently until golden. Then you want to stir in all of the other ingredients, including the tarragon mixture. And just having those, yeah, and then that kind of ensures you've got a nice distribution of tarragon throughout. Make sure your filling isn't too hot when you're spreading it, because that will kill yeast. And then what you do is you once your dough has doubled in size, you then will punch that down, roll it out to as kind of large as you can get, pretty much, and then like spread over your filling and then roll it up. And there's two different types of things you could do here. So you could use a 23 centimeter bundt pan if you have one. Mine is only 21 centimeters, and so it was a little bit big for it. By the way, I've made this smaller amount as well than so the recipes I was working off of, which were huge. Now, so you could use a bundt pan, ideally a 23 centimeter one, or you could literally you sort of like fold it in half so that you've got like a kind of like snake, if you know what I mean. It's like you've got it's sort of like turned in on itself, I guess. So you've got two rolls and you just pop that in a prepared loaf pan. So that's equally valid. I think if you look it up online, you'll see more often they will use a it's actually they don't it's not actually buntpan traditionally, it's a potinitsa, if that's correct, but it's basically a specific pan for petitsa, which is sort of a bit wider and flatter than a buntpan, but nobody's going to have that unless you're Slovenian, so that's why I've said you can use a buntpan. And I did see some petitsas that were made in buntpans as well, by the way, but it's not very traditional, I don't think. But yeah, there's lots of recipes where they have sort of fold it in half, if you like, and then put it in a loaf pan, and that's valid too. And then you get like two swirls when you're cutting into it, which is nice as well, isn't it? So, you know, I think I might try it that way next time. And then again, you want to bake it quite low and slow. So you can probably do 180 C or 350 Fahrenheit here. But yeah, you still want it quite low and slow, baking it for about an hour or so. The other thing that a lot of recipes seem to call for, so it seems to be a thing, is if you poke holes in it just before you bake it, and then it's meant to help it rise more evenly so you don't get like pockets of air. And then this is quite a nice tip. So when you're baking an enriched bread, if you want to be absolutely sure it's done in the middle, you can check the internal temperature. So recipes tend to say like around about 90 to 95 degrees C, which is about 203 Fahrenheit. So that's quite a useful method that I have been using, because sometimes if an enriched bread is filled, it can be quite tricky to sort of check if it's done if you're just using the skewer method or you're just tapping it and listening to it. So that's sort of useful to know. So yeah, those are our two bakes. In terms of how I found it to make the tarragon petitsa, quite tricky. And again, I think, yeah, I've made it 2-3 times and each time I've gotten better. So I think it's sort of worth persisting with recipes like this sometimes. And I never give up when I'm baking, because I do see baking as primarily a science. And I think that it's something where you get it wrong, okay, then you adjust the conditions and then you do your experiment again, if you like. You know, you change your variables and then you'll get a different outcome. So as much as it is also an art and a passion of mine, a very important passion, it is a science. And I think that that's what I always bear in mind is, you know, it's not that I'm bad at baking, it's that I did something wrong when I was conducting the method, you know? So, I kind of enjoy the challenge of doing new things and trying new bakes out. So, so it is a bit tricky, but quite a nice challenge. And tarragon in sweet food is an absolute game changer. There's a tarragon blondie in Benjamina Ebuehi's book, A Good Day to Bake, which I also love. That's a much easier recipe as well than petitsa. And I've made that for colleagues and they really enjoyed it. So very much worth thinking about. So yeah, those are our two bakes this week. And all that's left for me to talk about next is what's coming up. Right, so in our next episode, we're going to be focusing on a single ingredient, miso. And we're going to be using miso in a variety of ways, which I'm really excited to talk to you about. So I'm going to be talking about miso, brown butter, chocolate chip cookies, game changer. I'm going to be talking about a miso banana bread. I'm going to be talking about a vegan miso brownie, which it doesn't matter if you're not vegan, you have to try them. They're incredibly good. I'm telling you right now. And also I'm going to be talking about a miso maple an orange zest loaf cake. So plenty to talk about in the next episode. I'm going to talk a little bit about what miso is as well, and the importance of miso. So the next episode is all about miso. And then the one after that is going to be, I'm going to be talking about honeycomb fudge, maybe marshmallows. So like little kind of like confectionery, I guess, you know, little treats that you can make for presents for people. So that's our next couple of episodes. So I can't wait to see, to talk to you again in 2 weeks, all about miso. In the meantime, please go to our new website. You can still go to the old website for all of the previous recipes, which I might in time transfer over to the new website. But please go to our new website to subscribe to my newsletter, you know, to get all the recipes in your inbox, plus a reminder to listen to the episodes. And you can also listen to the episodes via the website as well. It's really quite clever. So the website, again, is homebaking.substack.com. And I look forward to talking to you soon. The email address hasn't changed. It's still flourbuttereggssugar@gmail.com. So yeah, hope that things are all right where you are. Take care and happy baking. Bye. Home Baking is written, recorded and produced by Kate Harris in London. And my little PS for this week is something I found out that's really interesting that I forgot to say earlier as well, which is that in a lot of Orthodox countries, see me really geeking out here about my religious history and religious practice stuff, but in a lot of Orthodox countries, Easter is a more important festival than Christmas. So I've grown up in Britain where Christmas is the festival. We do have Easter as well. You know, it is traditionally a Christian country. We have an established church even, which is wild if you ask me. You know, a state church. But yeah, Easter is sort of like nice, but Christmas is huge. Huge. Whereas, yeah, in a lot of Orthodox countries, including Ukraine, I was reading about this in Olya Hercules's book, Easter is the most important festival. So yeah, that's a little bit of knowledge that I found interesting. And when I worked at a Greek school, it was a really important festival for the Greek Cypriots that I worked with as well. So yeah, Easter. So yeah, hope you're well, and that's it for this week. Bye.